Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. You know, before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the rise of outlaw country music and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision in her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Hey, it's Amy Brown here to talk about St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. For 60 years, St. Jude doctors and researchers have helped push the overall childhood cancer survivor rate from 20% to more than 80%. But we need your help getting that number to 100%. And most important, your support means that families will never receive a bill from St. Jude for treatment, travel, housing, or food. Now, that peace of mind means so much. So join me in helping St. Jude in the fight against childhood cancer. Become a partner in hope and text Bobby to 785-833. That's B-O-B-B-Y to 785-833.
This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p. Welcome to episode 278. Hardy in studio. We'll talk to Barry Gibb of the Bee Gees, which is pretty crazy and legend. And I watched that documentary. Loved it. It's on HBO Max. We always start with the best new music releases of the week. Why don't we do this? Number 5, Tim McGraw released a stripped acoustic version of Something Like That. Older song, but pretty cool. Here you go.
That's a day I'll never forget. I had a barbecue stain on my white t-shirt. She was killing me in that miniskirt. Skipping rocks on the river by the railroad tracks. She had a suntan line and red lipstick.
At number 4, a new artist that I really like named Harper Gray, who has played on the radio show. She has a new song called Caviar and Bars. At number 3, Jeremiah, who is of the Lumineers, has a new album out called Piano Piano. It's his debut solo record. He's the hat and suspenders guy in the Lumineers. Here's a new song called An Air That Kills. By the way, it's all instrumental, but it feels like it's a movie when you're listening. Here you go. I feel like I should write words over this.
Rap over it?
Anything. Listen, I'm not going to spend any time listening to this, I don't think, but I do think it's interesting when people kind of hop out and do something a little different and on their own. Like with this project, you know he's not trying to go solo.
Yeah.
He's like, I got a little itch to scratch, but I do really like the Lumineers. At number 2, Lainey Wilson has a new song called Neon Diamonds. And number 1, my guy Brandon Ray has a new song out called Fresh. You know, there's a Billie Eilish song out, and I'll ask for your help here. It did make my top 5, but I think I should, you know, actually recognize that it's out. It's with Rosalía. Mike, I don't know how to pronounce it. Lo vas a
olvidar.
Go ahead.
Lo vas a olvidar.
Okay. And what does that mean?
You're going to forget.
I know I'm going to forget, yeah. But what does that mean?
The song title?
Yeah.
Like you're going to forget something.
Oh, I thought you meant I was going to forget how to say the
no,
title.
No, you're going to forget. That's the song title.
Okay, do you have a clip of that?
Yeah.
That Billie Eilish stuff is just consistently a little too dark for me.
Very whispery.
Yeah, this feels like it's a sex scene between two people who shouldn't be doing it. In a movie, you know, like there's cheating happening, and it's like when they get away, and it's like slightly against the rules. So it's just, yeah, it's a little too dark for me. New album's out today. Willie Jones released his debut album right now. Fraternity, which is Bon Scott, pre-ACDC, which Bon Scott was the lead singer originally, who died. And now Brian Johnson's the lead singer. But that's out. It's a box set. Steve Hackett, lead rocker from the Stray Cats. I think that's pretty much it. Not a lot of music this week, honestly. Music news, Eric Church is releasing 1, 2, 3 albums in April. The first one's called Heart, out April 16th. Here's the trend. Morgan Wallen puts out 2. Church puts out 3. I hear Luke Bryan's got a 9 album.
9 album?
Coming out. Yeah. They're just going to out-album each other now.
Here's a shipment of records.
The first one's Heart. Then there's Soul. And then there's one that's called End, like the end sign. What is that called? The ampersand?
Ampersand, yeah.
Yeah. And it's only available on vinyl for his church choir members. By the way, you'll probably be able to get it to eventually somewhere else. But that's just me guessing. So Heart and Soul. So Heart, Soul, whatever, you get it. There's 3 albums, Heart and Soul. But And only goes to the church choir. All right. Speaking of Eric Church and R&B singer Jasmine Sullivan will team up to perform the national anthem at the Super Bowl. The game is February 7th on CBS. The last time two singers performed it together was Aaron Neville and Aretha Franklin at the Super Bowl in Detroit. Lady A, the newest members of the Grand Ole Opry, they were invited Thursday by Darius Rucker during a taping of the Grand Ole Opry 95 Years of Country Music special. Their membership becomes effective immediately, which was a bit odd to see them be invited and they were already members, because usually what happens is you get invited, then you have the night where you're inducted. Mm-hmm. But I guess because of COVID, it's like, all right, we want you to be a member and you're a member, because you can't really do the big pomp and circumstance. That show should be interesting. I'm supposed to be a part of it because I work with the Opry and play the Opry a lot. But the struggle for me is that show is on the same night that American Idol debuts.
Oh.
But I don't do the first episodes of Idol because I was off shooting my other show. I don't know what's going to happen, but hopefully I can still be a part of the Opry show. I think it'll be pretty cool. Dolly Parton's brother dies. Randy Parton has died of cancer. He was a singer and a musician who played in Dolly's band, also had a show of his own at Dollywood. Probably best known for his duet with Dolly, Old Flames Can't Hold a Candle to You, which, by the way, Dolly celebrated her 75th birthday on Tuesday. Brandi Clark postpones her tour. She's the latest artist to postpone or cancel tour dates. I mean, you kind of have to, right?
It's getting there, yeah.
It's getting there in what way? I feel like it's not near close to being there.
Well, to where you, like, you can't have anything that's not going to happen, people still holding tickets for.
So help me out here.
Yeah.
Was this the tour that she was already doing, like she announced a long time ago?
Yeah, and rescheduled. So then it's like done.
Got it. Okay. I was thinking, because you're not going to go, hey, we're going to start touring in February.
And then, yeah.
So it was the tour that originally was planned. Mm-hmm. And then rescheduled, like Maren had to do.
Like Maren, yeah.
Okay. Olivia Rodrigo is the youngest ever with a number one song with her song Driver's License. Get my driver's license last week. Just like we... I mean, I hear the song all the time. Caitlin loves it. She was and is in High School Musical, and she was dating the other dude in High School Musical. And then he started dating Sabrina Carpenter, thank you. And then she wrote this song and...
Got my driver's license last week, just like we always talked about. Cause you were so excited for me to finally drive up to.
She turns 18 next month. It debuted number one on the chart, which has happened fewer times than 50 times in history. Boy. Finally, no, I got two or three left. Hip to Be Square by Huey Lewis and Metallica. They match exactly. Someone posted this mashup on YouTube. Check it out. I feel like they sped up the vocals a bit.
A little bit.
So it doesn't match perfectly. Cool. They said that it's a nice little mix that someone did, but that's sped up, the Metallica stuff. Still fun to hear. All right, cool. Barry Gibb has the second best selling album of the week, who we'll talk to later. Barry Gibb's new solo album did pretty well. Barry Gibb and Friends. It debuted at number 2. He's from the Bee Gees. I mean, I didn't realize really the impact of the Bee Gees. I knew their songs, but the impact in general until I watched that documentary, and it was fantastic. I mean, they were before me, but you just realize what a legend this guy was. I mean, holy crap, they got famous like 3 times, all different levels, and after they weren't famous anymore, they wrote massive hits for people, including Islands in the Stream. Taylor Swift's 2 records were number 3 and number 4. Drake's new album, Certified Lover Boy, is it coming out this month after all? He says all his energy has been dedicated to his recovery from knee surgery. There you go. It's the second delay for Certified Lover Boy. It was originally supposed to come out last summer. That's your music news. That's your music releases. And that is it. What's the order we're doing here?
We'll do Hardy first.
Okay. You're going to love the interview with Hardy. And then Barry Gibb from the Bee Gees. Thank you, guys. Check out Mike's podcast, Movie Mike's Movie Podcast. What's on this week, Mike?
I have Eddie on. We're talking about Matthew McConaughey.
Eddie's your guest.
Yep.
All right. He's not guesting on this week, so I guess he's got to find a spot somewhere.
Yep.
All right. Check out Movie Mike's Movie Podcast. Thank you, guys.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events, there is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com.
Tecovas.com. Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts. That's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer, and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only 6 numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833. All right, with Hardy here in the studio. We never met before this, which is weird because you've been around for a bit now. And I've been around for a bit.
Yeah.
But we didn't even run into each other the few chance times that we were both out, you know, at CMAs or ACMs.
I feel like, too, the last time I was at, like, an actual award show, like a red carpet where people were, you know, pre-COVID, was, like, over a year ago, obviously. So, yeah, I think I've only literally seen you like once ever, like in passing.
The
so.
Rare unicorn.
But, I mean, except for kind of the would you say that's a mullet? Not a mullet, long
no,
hair. It's a weird tweener. It
yeah,
is a tweener.
Yeah, it's a tweener for sure.
Other than that, I would say we're similarishly looking.
Yeah, I would think so.
And we got the
we're thinner than me.
Generic white. We're both generic white guys though.
Yeah.
That have dark rim glasses.
Yeah.
You can still pull off the flat bill cap. Once I turned 40 this last year, I was like, I'm out. I
got no hats anymore.
Not hats, but I can't do flat bills.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm a little too old to really rock the flat ones.
I think that for the most part, every body is too old. I think they're like just going away for the most part. I was literally talking to somebody about that earlier. It's like people just, no matter who you are, look less cool these days in a flat bill. I don't know why.
Has it been a bit odd to finally get recognition as Hardy the artist and you really can't do anything with it?
What do you mean?
Well, because here you have a number one song on the radio.
Right.
You have a ton of songwriting hits, but nobody outside of our community knows who the songwriters are for the most part. Anyway,
sure.
Right. That's
yeah.
That's a celebrated job, a well-paying job if you hit big inside
sure.
of our bubble.
Yeah.
But you can't go to, you know, Tupelo or Lexington and play a full show as a songwriter.
No, you can't.
You can't sell out, you know, Rupp Arena.
No, definitely not.
So your success as an artist, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, it's mostly your the peak of it has been when we can't do crap.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I get what you're saying. Yeah, it's been tough, dude. And I really felt like I have to think about timeline. Our last few shows were, I guess, around this time last year. And we were finally, you know, selling out, like, bigger, biggish rooms and stuff. And, I mean, our set was, like, amazing. And we were really dialed in. And everything went away. So, but, yeah, it's been kind of tough on that end. But the songwriting is cool. I mean, it's like I get to play covers, quote unquote,
yeah,
in the set
wrote.
That I wrote. Yeah. And so I kind of don't have to do real covers and get to play some of the stuff that I've written. And I try to explain it live, and I don't know if it translates, you know, if people really are listening. But, yeah, it's cool.
I wonder how many people, because, again, we're so into the industry in different ways, but I wonder how many people that go to a show that don't know the ends of it actually know what you're saying when you're talking, going, hey, I wrote God's Country from Blake Shelton. And then you play it. And how many go, oh, yeah, he's covering this song. This is a good one.
Yeah, I probably a lot.
I would think so, too. I think we give ourselves too much credit that people listen to everything we say.
Yeah, I think so, especially, like, in bars. Like, arenas and stuff are probably different. I haven't gotten to do that in arenas, obviously. But like, in bars, and they're loud, and everybody's drunk, and you know that they're probably not paying attention.
You're number one as an artist. Song, your first one,
yeah,
is, and this is mostly what I was referring to, because I know you've built a base and you've opened up for other big artists,
right?
But for you to have a song that has extreme mass appeal and people to go, oh, it's the guy that did One Beer,
yeah,
like that hasn't been able to happen quite yet. Because
no, I mean, because no, we haven't really played shows since it happened.
Yeah,
yeah.
Let me play this first. Here is One Beer. On the record, this hits slightly different than the rest of the songs.
Yeah.
So whenever this was decided to go to, you know, radio, conventional radio,
yeah,
was someone really pushing that and it was like, wow, we can't believe we're going to do this? Or was that kind of the consensus to go with that song?
Yeah, it was just the internet.
It was data of...
It stood, I mean, oddly enough, too, it was on Hixtape. It wasn't even originally on my... my actual record. It was a Hixtape song, and of all the songs, we knew we were probably gonna do a single from Hixtape, and Seth England kept saying, like, dude, it's gonna be One Beer, you just watch. And I was like, okay. And sure enough, it, I mean, exponentially beat everything else on the record. And I've always been I've only been doing this a couple years, but like, anything that I cut, I would be willing to do to have as a single. So whatever that they, you know, say is blowing up on, you know, whatever internet, any app or whatever, I'm good to go with. So I just said, let's do it. I know it's different, but go for it.
There's only ever been one other person say that in that way to me, when doing these long form conversations, and he said, you know what, I write almost all my stuff, not all of it. He's like, I'll take a couple songs that I don't write because I'm a songwriter and I appreciate songwriters. And he said, but if I cut it, I just go, it's good enough to put out. So you decide, because I wouldn't have cut it if I didn't think it was good.
Yeah.
And that was Chris Stapleton.
Yeah, wow.
Who goes, I cut it. I got to believe in it. So, yeah. So label, you take it and do what you're good at, because I already did what I'm good at.
Yeah. That's how I feel. Pretty much exactly the same. I'm cool with anything. I know there's kind of a whole spectrum of sonically of stuff that I put out, but I'm cool with anything going out there.
When'd you move to town?
10 and a half years ago.
That's when you moved here officially?
Yes.
When did you come to town the first time and go, I can't believe people get paid to do that?
About 11 years ago. Well, my sister moved here before I did. She's a year and a half older than me.
To do music?
Yes, originally. And now she's, you know, found her own path and she's doing something completely different. But, and so I was in like late high school, like senior year high school / junior college. And she was going to Belmont and she hit me up and I had just started like writing songs and stuff. And she was like, hey, I don't know like what you're trying to do with your life pretty much, but there's a thing called a publishing deal and there's a whole industry where you get paid to write songs if you ever wanted to do that. And I just kind of on a whim was like, sure. And just moved up here and you know, that's kind of when everything started.
So you moved up here from Mississippi?
Yeah.
Where were you living? Because you're from Philadelphia, Mississippi?
Yeah.
I'm from Arkansas and we played a lot of ball all around, you know, Arkansas, Mississippi, yeah. Alabama.
Have you ever been there?
Yeah, I've been through.
Really?
Yeah, wow. I have. I've been through almost all of Mississippi.
Yeah.
When you don't come from a place that has a lot, you go to other places that don't have a lot.
Yeah, sure. Wow, that makes sense. Yeah.
So
totally.
You just move around. And so, yeah, I've been through there a couple times. And so you were living there in high school. Is that when you moved after high school?
I went to 1 year of junior college and it was like a joke. I mean, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was such a terrible student. And I ended up going to college here, but, I knew I needed to leave too. So I was technically in, I would come home on the weekends, but Decatur, Mississippi, which is like 25 minutes away from Philadelphia. But yeah, technically I was in Philadelphia when I moved here.
So you move up here to go to school?
Yeah, I went to MTSU. And so I lived in Nashville for the summer, and then I lived in Murfreesboro for like a year, and then I moved back and just commuted for the rest of the time.
When you're at MTSU, who has a good music school?
Yeah, it's like the poor man's Belmont.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's why I said it has a good music school.
Yeah,
you know, Belmont's the
fancy. It's like the end of Music Row. Yeah. It's like the castle on top of the hill.
Yeah, you graduate, you get a number one record, but you go and you study songwriting there. What in the world do you learn in school as a songwriter?
You know, it was really interesting, and I hate saying this, but the class itself, you kind of either got it or you don't. And I don't know. I learned more about publishing and like the music industry and kind of how not to get screwed in a contract, and which that's what lawyers are for too. But I learned more about that, I think, than the actual craft of writing a song. But I did learn a lot about publishing and a lot of music industry terminology and like 360 deals and stuff like that. I really got I took a lot in from that based on that major.
And also you meet people who then introduce you to people who then introduce you to people.
Yeah, totally. And that's what I always do add. It's like I understand that if I didn't do that, I definitely wouldn't be here. And I kind of had a weird college experience and only had a couple of friends. So I stayed in my room a lot and just like really learned how to write songs by myself. And if I didn't do that, you know, I wouldn't have kind of developed my portfolio for signing a publishing deal and all that. So it was definitely worth it.
Did you finish school?
Yeah, I have a degree.
Nice.
I believe it or not, I definitely do. It's in commercial songwriting. Which is insane.
So you finished school. You're in Nashville full time. How long? And I assume you finished school at 22, 23, around that age?
Yeah, yeah.
How long until you're actually getting to pay the bills writing songs?
So I signed a publishing deal. I graduated in August, so I had to do like a 4.5 semesters, and I did summer to finish. And so September, October, November, December, January, February. 6 months. 6 months after college. I signed my first publishing deal.
What song or songs do you remember sending out? Because you kind of have this collection of material to go, hey guys, please sign me.
Yeah.
Do you remember? Did you have anything that is still floating around or ended up getting cut in that first batch of?
No, I didn't even get a cut on my first publishing deal until I signed my second deal, and then I got one cut.
They paid you for a whole deal and made no money off of you.
Yeah. I had one song about a dog that was really good that, like, got pitched around, and that was, like, on my Schedule A, so it was one of the songs that I came into my deal with that still I will hear, maybe will go on hold or something. But, no, nothing that I wrote before my pub deal has seen the light of day for the most part.
Did you re-sign with your original pub company for your second deal?
Yeah.
Thank God, because, man, they'd just been screwed. They just spent all this money on you and didn't get anything.
It's kind of a interesting. My publisher is a relative of mine. No kidding. And so we kind of, right at the beginning, sort of had a dream together, and he just kept saying, dude, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And, I went with him again.
How many years was your first deal?
Three.
Are you, after year two, you're going into year three, are you like, man, I don't know if this is going to happen.
Yeah, I was discouraged for sure. I was.
Why wasn't it happening? Were you not good enough yet?
I think so. Yeah. And it's so funny because I was so, like, mad. I wasn't bitter, and I wasn't, what's the word? I didn't blame the industry, and I wasn't that guy, but I was very frustrated. But I know, and there were a few songs, but there is proof in the pudding that I only got, like, one cut from my first deal, and I wasn't there yet. The songs weren't. I go back and listen to them all the time, and I just kind of pick them apart, and I'm like, yeah, it wasn't the radio yet.
You ever go back and listen to an old song and then a bit rewrite it and make it better?
No.
Years later, like as exercise.
If anything, I would, and I don't even think I've done this on purpose, but you know, you write 1,000 songs, so you got to write the same title eventually, even if you forget about it. But if anything, if I had a great, great idea or title that maybe I didn't know how to write, I would, or I might, like, rewrite the whole idea. And if it was a co-write, just split that with the people, or either rewrite it with them or something like that. I'd be down for that.
Your first money-making song was Up Down?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Was that the first song that ever got cut?
No. My first cut was, but that was actually, so two cuts. Up Down was on my old deal. I Should Go to Church Sometime by Tyler Farr.
Oh, yeah.
It was my first cut, and it was my first single, and it died like in the 60s.
Remember it, yeah. 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 But still exciting to get that first single. When you get the call and they go, hey, it's a single, are you pumped?
Yeah. Oh, dude, yeah. I mean, I thought I was going to be rich. not that that's why I do it, but yeah, I was. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge milestone and just a confidence booster, and it's like, you are doing this, and somebody legitimate cut your song, and yeah, it was all the wind in the sails, I think, that I needed. And then after that, everything just kind of started happening, which is, everybody says, like, you get one and you get X amount or whatever, and I've seen that happen with a ton of my friends too. It's just funny how that works.
So as much wind gets put in your sails when they say, hey, it's going to be a single, did as much get taken out when it didn't hit?
Yes, but Up Down kind of cross-faded with that, so I had a little hope there. But around the time it died was when Morgan cut it. So we just still didn't know, and he had only had The Way I Talk. So it's hard to, you know, really gauge that. But, it was a good – it was enough crossfade for me to not, like, be super down and think maybe that was my shot.
There had to be two – a bit of excitement whenever it's not only Morgan, who at the time was an unknown artist on a label, sure, who had no history at all, not even of success or not success, but no history. Big Loud had no history. But then when FGL gets on the song, you got to go, oh man, I got another bullet for the gun inside of this song.
Yeah, it was a huge booster for him, and that was kind of a sigh of relief.
But for you, I'm saying, like, to write a song, you know, if FGL's on the song, it's not gonna die at 60.
No. And that was kind of the, okay, this is going to be a hit. There's no way it's not going to be a hit. And that was definitely a huge thing for all of us. That was all me, Brad Clausen, and CJ Solar. It was our first, really a few of our first cut, or maybe mine and somebody else's, like, first or second cut, and our first hit together too. So it was good for all of us.
Let me play this. Here is Morgan Wallen, Up Down.
Turn it up, down, up, down.
You mentioned Brad Clausen. So when I heard about you, the songwriter, about to start turning into you, the artist, it was from Nicole Galyon, who's a friend.
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah, Hardy's, he's going to try to be an artist.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who you were. I just
Nobody did.
She was talking about the songs you'd written, and she was like, "I don't know why I'd try that."
Yeah,
you know, because a lot of songwriters in town have either tried and it was unsuccessful, not a good experience, or they just don't want to do it.
Yeah, you know, see all their friends do it, and they're like, "I don't know about that."
You never have someone who's a songwriter who hits it big for a couple songs and goes, "You know what? I'm good. I don't want to do it." Uh-uh. It's never that way. So, you know, if you're with a songwriter, mostly they're like, "I don't know. I want to live the artist lifestyle."
Yeah.
But for you, was that always kind of the goal on the—
No, it was not. When I was in college, like, I kind of wanted to, and then I signed a pub deal and I was just like, "This is awesome. And all I got to do is write a song every day." I had reached the point where I had zero intentions of being an artist, or at least like signing a record deal and like doing the thing. I might have had aspirations to put music out or something, but no, I had no plans to do it.
I'm going to ask you, this is a weird question to ask, and I know what the answer is, but I wonder what your answer is. When you say you didn't have aspirations to be an artist, can you sing?
Yes.
Like, can you? Are you like, I've never heard you sing, right? You haven't been on the show, the radio show to play, and I haven't seen you live. So I just go by the records. And some of my friends that are great artists can sing pretty well.
Yeah.
But they go, "You know what? I'm not the best singer. I'm a good songwriter, a great performer, but can you sing?"
I think so, yes.
Do you understand the question? Like, do you think that you can sing compared to Nashville?
Yeah, I do. I think it took me a while to figure that out or to find my voice, but, yes, I do. I consider myself a vocalist, very much so.
Whenever you were coming up and you were looking at artists, or maybe you even just listened to artists when you were growing up in Mississippi, who was it that you were like, "Dang, let's," because I assume you're in your 30s or 30. Like 20?
Okay, yeah, I'm 30. Years old. Yeah.
So I grew up with Napster and we started to download and then stream, right?
Sure,
so
yeah.
So I was able to get music from every direction. Mm-hmm. Really, I was the first generation to do that, where just because I grew up in Mountain Pine, Arkansas, population 700, didn't mean I wasn't listening to Tupac,
sure,
and Limp Bizkit,
yeah,
and Brooks and Dunn.
Yeah.
So we have all of this music coming from different angles. So I'm going to ask you, what came to you from outside of country music first, where you were like, "God dang, man, this is what I love."
Dude, well, rock and roll in general, I didn't grow up listening to country. I know that's like against the country music Bible, but... So it was all rock and roll. A lot of old just from my dad, and I still love classic rock, but Stone Temple Pilots, Soundgarden, Puddle of Mud, Limp Bizkit.
Yeah, the whole 90s vibe for you sounds like it was...
Yeah, late 90s transitional to like early 2000s. Honestly, Nickelback, dude, when they first came out, dude, that some of those songs, they were such hits, and my mind was blown. So
I'm a Nickelback defender to my core.
Me too, man.
Because the only reason people hate Nickelback is because they got so freaking famous.
Yeah.
And when somebody is so famous,
you can't help but get...
The cool thing to say is, "I don't like them."
Yeah, sure.
I just watched the Bee Gees documentary, and I didn't get to experience the Bee Gees. That was way too old for me. But they got so big, and there was such a backlash
that people just started hating on them.
That it was just a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
Because everybody loved them, so I'm going to be cool and go like, "You know what? I don't love them."
Yeah.
And then it slowly starts to be a movement.
Sure.
And I've seen that. And I don't know why. And listen, I have friends that have hung out with those guys, and they're like, "They're total douchebags." It doesn't matter to me. Their music was great at the time.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was just, to me, it was mind-blowing too. And kind of, you know, that was like, even though like you said, Napster and whatever, all the LimeWire or whatever, all the illegal things were, we still kind of had that beauty of hearing music for the first time without having like complete access to it like we do now. And so when I heard stuff like Nickelback, Linkin Park is another one. That stuff just, it did something to me, man. Like, just completely inspired me. I don't even know how to explain it. But
favorite artist of all time?
Pink Floyd.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, similar, I grew up listening to classic rock radio.
Yeah.
And so I was, like, CCR, Creedence, is really one of the most influential parts of music history to me.
Yeah.
But I would assume that had to be it for your dad.
Yes, 100%. And
classic rock radio?
Yeah. I mean, my first memory, like, my first few memories were, my dad had a chicken farm for a long time, and he had, like, this little S10, and we would listen to the classic rock station out of Jackson, Mississippi. And those are like, I was probably 3 years old. I remember hearing Freebird for the first time, and then like I heard it. I don't know how I remember this, but like later that day, I heard it again on the radio, and he was singing it, and I was still kind of learning the concept of radio. And I remember asking my dad how do you know that song? Because the first time we heard it was earlier today, and he was like, "No, son, that's like actually an old song." But yeah, classic rock radio was like very early in my childhood.
Your dad's still alive?
Yeah.
And what's he think about what you're doing now?
He's taking it all in stride. Both my parents are. They love it. Their mind is kind of blown a little bit. My sister was, I was very much a black sheep, and they will even admit this, that she sang growing up, and I was just a kid and played baseball, and sort of, she moved to Nashville, and, you know, this was kind of her thing, and so it's just still sort of, people are still in shock a little bit that the roles are kind of reversed, but my parents are, they love it.
Have they seen you perform to a pretty crowded room?
My folks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
First time they saw that, they trip out a little bit?
Yeah, the first time that they saw a good show was in Atlanta, and it was the first time that a crowd ever sang Rednecker. It was when Rednecker was like kind of peaking, and they were in the crowd, and when I came backstage, like my mom was like crying a little bit or whatever, and they were just, I had never seen them freak out like that. It was really cool.
Mike D, who's producing this, I was doing stand-up and playing theaters around the country, and Mike D was opening for him, and he was doing, you know, 5 to 7 minutes of comedy, but yeah. His parents didn't even know he was doing comedy. So we're we're in Austin, and it was the first time they'd come to see you, right?
First time ever.
And oh my God.
So similar. What did they think?
They freaked out. Like, they saw me walk out on stage and start telling jokes and like people laughing, and they were like, "What is happening?"
That's
right
amazing,
now?
Man.
Because he's so quiet. He says nothing.
Yeah.
But then he gets up on stage and is a pretty funny guy. And I just kind of wonder if that was the same thing with your folks a little bit.
I think so. Yes, I think so. And they hadn't really seen that side of me, but they did also like. My first show ever was like this Halloween show I did in Nashville, and it was like packed with industry people. So everybody was like extra hyped just because it was like my first show and everybody knew, like yeah. We knew each other. But the real, like to see it in front of real fans, I think was a whole different experience for them and for me.
Where did Rednecker peak?
23, maybe 24.
So you were right on the edge of really feeling it though, huh?
Yeah. It definitely took, it's interesting though, because it didn't like one beer. The fan base was like kind of learning the stuff before even One Beer kind of went top 20, and they knew Rednecker, and it's still like the biggest, if not second biggest song of the night. But yeah, I mean, it took a different turn when One Beer came out for sure.
After Up Down goes and hits, was it crossing with any other songs at the same time?
Yeah. So, Simple came out right after that. I think Simple came out in like June or something, and Up Down went number one in July. So that was like the first like crossover. And I remember at Up Down at the number one party, Simple was number one. It was like a crazy, cool kind of moment, you know.
Here is FGL Simple.
It's like 1, 2, 3, just as easy as can be. Just the way you look at me, you make me smile.
With your second song that hits, or are you starting to go, hey, I think I'm really going to do this for a while? Like there's a pressure off your shoulders?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I think like Up Down like stood alone, and then I started really going on the road with FGL, and Morgan was out there, and Chris Lane was, they were all on tour together. And the next thing I know, Chris Lane came up and was like, hey, I'm going to cut this song you wrote. I don't know about you. And then like, and a couple others. And then Morgan, he and I started writing a lot. And he was like, I'm going to cut this and this and this and this with you. And then kind of FGL sort of followed suit. And that's like when I really knew like, okay, I think I have a camp. And, you know, because that's kind of the name of the game for the most part. You know, if you can at least find a crew and then you branch out and get cuts sort of here and there. Everywhere else, but I never really had like a solid camp of people that I could trust in and like felt like I was maybe their guy or this dude's guy or whatever, and that was the first time that I felt a lot of security from that.
Here's Chris Lane, I Don't Know About You.
What's your name, what's your sign, what's your birthday, what's your wrist tattoo, Bible verse, say, tell me this.
want to run through some of these. Here's Low Cash, One Big Country Song. Turn it up and sing along. We all work till the daylight's gone. We all knock off the edge around five. Here is Jameis and Roger, Some Girls. Some girls get the mama on the phone, take a trip back home, pretend they never knew the guy. Some girls drink a bottle of wine. Here's Blake Shelton, God's Country. I saw the light in a sunrise. When Devin Dawson was in here, about a week or so ago, he said you sang the demo to this.
Yeah.
And that when you guys finished it, in his recollection, he said, hey, you go into writing room, everybody has different memories of what happens when.
Right, sure.
That he felt like that was a song for you.
Yeah, I made a joke to Seth and Joey, Joey Moy, and I sent it to them, and I said, I can't remember, and I've tried to find the text, and that, you know, like it gets deleted after a year or whatever, but I said something like, unless somebody like Blake Shelton cuts this in a week, I want this for myself. And Blake cut it like 5 days later.
Now, you okay. Listen, you're pumped when he cuts it.
Yeah.
99%, but it was 1% of you like, man, I sure wish I could cut that song.
No. Really? I had never, dude, I had modeled my, like, there, Blake had put out so many songs that I loved and that I had, like, sort of gravitated towards that craft. And a lot of that was because of Craig Wiseman and, like, just other people that had Blake cuts, but, it was such a dream of mine to have a Blake cut, and especially one that he was hyped about. So I didn't even think twice about it. And I don't think that the song would have been as big for me as it was for him. I think it was so big as because it was so different.
Well, for him, it was the biggest song of the year. I mean, that song was the song.
I suppose so.
No, I suppose it won. It won song of, like, it literally was the single of the year.
Yeah.
So there's no supposing. That was it. I'm going to play, here's one more he wrote, Morgan Wallen, More Than My Hometown. I love you more than a California sunset, more than a beer when you ain't 21, yeah, more than a... So by doing math here, let's see, nine number ones. You're worth about $10 million. I'm just saying. Is that how that works?
Think, unless you write Meant to Be or something, I don't know if those are that much.
All right. So your record... And again, I'm going to reference Stapleton for a second, because when Stapleton put out From a Room, Part 1 and Part 2, the big thing was, is it From a Room or From a Room?
Right.
And it's From a Room.
Right.
Because that's the room. A Room.
Yes.
Now with your record, is it a rock or is it a rock?
You know what's funny is it's probably a rock because a rock sounds like Iraq.
Why?
I've heard that joke a lot recently. I'm like, man, I didn't think about that.
Why a rock, though?
Well, it's, you know, it is a song on the record, but also I think there's a little bit of a wordplay there with that the record sounds like a rock record.
I didn't cross into that word.
That's why I decided on that. I thought of a million ideas, and I can't even think of them now, but that's what we ended up with, and I do think that, you know, the record does definitely sound like a rock record, and that it was just, you know, aesthetically pleasing or whatever.
Yeah, is the new single out? If you guys
it goes for ads Monday.
What is it?
Give Heaven Some Hell.
All right, let me play a little bit of this.
Yeah.
This is From. Did you write this one?
Yeah.
Did you write all the songs on the record?
Yes.
I've heard this song a few times.
Yeah.
Where have I heard this, though, that it would play other than just me checking out the record? Do you know? Have you played it anywhere?
I played it at a WWE thing. It was like the troops thing. It was on TV. I don't know if you saw that. I don't know.
I missed that one.
You never know.
Give me the 30-second version of You're in the Room, the concept, what the song means to you.
Okay, so we were writing, the first song on my record is called Truck, and originally the last half of the second verse, there's a line about a guy that has a sticker on the back that says 92 to 2012 in memory of his buddy, and we originally made the line, he misses him, or stories he can barely tell because he's giving heaven some hell, and me and Hunter Phelps and Ben Johnson, we were all like, that needs to be its own idea. And so we changed the line and we wrote down Give Heaven Some Hell, and we wrote it like a week later. And to be honest, you know, I don't, I've never lost like a best friend, thankfully, or anything like that. And so I wasn't pulling from like a real like experience or anything like that. But I've definitely experienced it, you know, secondhand or, you know, there's stuff like that happened in my hometown a lot. So there was no particular person in mind, but I will say, man, it's been the heaviest, like my Instagram and Twitter and stuff, just literally like thousands of just stories of people. And I try to respond to all of them, but I know that it's reaching people, and that's really the kind of the realization I've had this year is to have a platform where I can help people or at least try to make people feel something. So I'm really proud of that one.
I mean, you're hitting on all cylinders. Usually it's one or the other, and sometimes they shift.
Sure.
But right now you're kind of hitting in all areas. Do you have any other songs that you have written for other folks that are out or starting to kind of flutter around a little bit?
Like that I wrote that just that other singles?
Yeah. Maybe not even singles. Are there other, you know, I'm assuming, I don't know this is true, but on Morgan's record, you're on some of those songs.
Yeah.
You wrote some of those.
Yeah, I had a few on Morgan's. And right now I have like Cole Swindell's single Saturday Night. This guy Robert Counts, he has a single out called What Do I Know? And then Dylan Carmichael has a song called Hot Beer. I've been writing a lot with Dirks recently.
Isn't Dirks the best dude? Like aside from just being, you know, the songwriter, and I've been lucky to be friends with Dirks on a different level than
yeah.
He's just the best guy.
Dude, yes.
He's as solid as you can get in town.
And I've found that a lot of the guys that are like at the top are like that. And you know that. Luke Bryan, Blake Shelton, and a lot of those guys, like you're around them and you're like, man, y'all are just normal. You're just like you are, you know, on TV and everything and just good dudes. And I love that, man. If I ever get there, that's a testament to how I want to be one day, you know?
And here's why. Because people at that level don't have to prove anything to anybody.
Sure.
You know, I'll say a two single new artist, no offense to yourself,
it's okay.
Or like a soap opera star or someone that's new on a TV show. In that, when you get that first taste of success, you start to go, I got to prove that I'm worth to be here. And to prove my worth, I need to be a certain way. And you start to have this. And I think I went through it a bit too when some of my TV stuff, not that I treated people different, but I was like, I got to show people that I'm actually worth what I'm getting to do.
Yeah.
And it's a weird feeling to have.
Yeah.
But then once you prove it to yourself, you're like, you know what? I kind of have what is sustainable. I'm just going to be who I am.
Yeah.
And those guys are like that.
Yeah.
Keith Urban.
Yes. He's another one, dude.
The greatest dude.
I know. So nice, man.
You just would be like, are you Little Big Town?
Yes. Oh, dude. Yes.
You're like, are you guys real? You hang around them and you're like, one day I'm going to catch you getting out of character. But they're never out of character because that's just who they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting too, and like just how they handle success and I look at them. I mean, I don't know if they know, but all those people that you mentioned are like role models at this point because I just want to be like that as a person if I ever get to be to that point, you know?
Yeah, I think it's just an insecurity that you can't create and be secure. Like you can't be a creator and not be insecure in some way.
I agree with that.
Because you're laying it out there in a vulnerable way every single time.
Yeah, totally.
It doesn't matter if you're writing songs or writing books. You got to go, okay, I've created this. Will you please like it?
Yeah, sure.
And to do that.
And you want people's approval. You need it. That's why you didn't do it. You know, wouldn't have done it in the first place.
And do that, you got to open up your ribs a little bit.
Yeah.
And so when that happens, I was tending to get extremely insecure and just be withdrawn. More than be angry. I was just, or mean. I was just completely withdrawn.
Yeah.
Now, not so much.
Sure.
I'm like, okay, I think I'm going to be here for a bit. I feel confident.
Yeah.
But I think it's the same thing. You just brought up a great point. Luke Bryan, we're together all the time shooting American Idol.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
And people are always like, Luke's worth $50, $60, $70 million. And he's like the nicest, coolest guy in the world.
Yeah. You never know.
Almost as much as you with all these songs. Come on now. When you tell people you're from Philadelphia, or do you ever just say Philadelphia and see if they can put it together?
Dude, every time I meet somebody new, I have to, we go through the thing. Every single time. Yeah, I say it. And when I say Philadelphia, like I see their confused face for like a split second. And then I say Mississippi and they're like, oh, make a joke about it. But
when you started writing,
Did you go by a full name or you always Hardy? You did?
Yeah, I did. It's just that Hardy, like all of my friends call me Hardy. And I don't know. It's just like kind of one of those. Like I have a couple buddies that I just have always called them by their last name for whatever reason. And so when it just came time to sort of do the artist thing, that somebody kind of brought it up and I was like, yeah, I think that's cool. Something different. And
why all caps?
It's just bold.
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of, you know, Rednecker being the first song, and I think the music being a little more intense than maybe some of the stuff in the format. I just, you know, I think it just stands out.
Are you feeling, and again, I don't want you to take this the wrong way because I compared you and I both to average white guys. If you just see us, we're just normal dudes. You know, we don't. That there's, I would call it kind of a normal core happening in country music. You know, this hardcore, but like you look normal.
Yeah.
Luke Combs looks normal.
Luke Combs created normal core. I think for the longest time, a lot of country acts before him, and really Stapleton kind of, in a way, in my opinion, maybe sort of helped develop that, but I think Luke Combs kind of delivered it to everybody. But yeah, it's cool to look normal again. I think before that, it was like everybody was like, either was or was trying to look like a professional wrestler or something.
Yeah, either an extreme cowboy, a chained up wrestler.
Yes.
Like you had to have your aesthetic niche.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to have that anymore.
No.
Just show up and do what you're good at.
Yep. And if you're good, I mean, the more normal you look, I feel like if you're, you know, if you're good, people are going to go nuts. Yeah.
When Jameson Rogers was here, he was leaving that night after we had talked to go and play in the softball.
Yeah.
The league that you guys were playing in.
Yeah.
And so, I know you were on the team. How physically are you holding up when you go back and play ball?
I was sore. I hurt. I hurt my knee or something like the last game. That was a big like, oh God, I'm getting old kind of thought. But dude, that was fun.
Yeah, I bet
that was so fun.
And you guys didn't win the whole thing, huh?
No,
you were freaking stacked.
I know. Man, it was. I tell you why we got beat. And myself included, everybody tried to hit a home run every single time they got up to bat. So I would bet 80% of our outs were long fly balls. It just, we couldn't help it. Like everybody wanted to hit a home run. I swear, because we were good in the field. We had great outfielders. We had good infield. We didn't make a ton of errors. We would have to, our at-bats were tough. We were good. We won a decent bit of games, but no, we didn't go all the way.
Do you feel like you had a target on your back because you were all the singers? Like when you were?
Oh, without a doubt, dude. Oh, my gosh.
So you were the Duke of college basketball. Like even the bad teams are gearing up because they're about to play as hard as they've ever played.
Absolutely. Oh, man, there were some teams. Some of the guys were really cool, and they would like kind of yell at us and make like a song reference joke or, you know, just something like that. And then there were a couple teams that like, you could just tell they were like these freaking country singer yada yada yadas, and oh dude, we felt it every single game. It was intense.
Did you ever finish a game and the other guys be like, "Hey, can I get a picture before we get out?"
Yeah, and by the end, you know, Morgan was only at a few. He had a lot going on, you know, but thank God he wasn't at every game, or I think it might have been chaos because it was just sort of at his. He was really starting to peak, which there was a ton of, you know, like celebrity singers on our team, but
Chris Lane, let's walk through it.
Yeah.
Chris Lane, you, Jameson, Jordan Davis. Obviously Morgan, there's five.
Five. Riley Green played one game. he didn't come back. John Langston was there.
God, you're not the team I would want to fight either.
Jeez. No, we were, yeah.
A thick bunch.
Yeah, for sure. Ernest, yeah, I don't know if you know Ernest.
I don't know. I say him on Twitter sometimes, but yeah, I don't know him.
He was on there, and then some of the younger guys, Jeb Gibson, Hunter Phelps, and it was cool, man. It was our team name was the Recoupables. I don't know. You probably saw it on Jameson. Was he wearing his jersey in
here? I think I saw it on Instagram. Maybe Jordan had posted a picture or something, yeah. Which I think is hilarious because, in case you don't know, a Recoupable, you have to pay the money back that the label pays you.
Right.
Because they're like, hey, we're going to give you $5 to go make a record. Well, you got to pay that $5
back.
Yeah,
the $5 is recoupable.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, that's – and you guys had jerseys?
Yeah, not – I guess they were not like jersey in form or in material. But, yeah, we had uniforms. We had like just very classic looking baseball shirt.
Does someone buy all them for you? Do you all have to go out and do it yourself?
Jameson handled the whole thing, and we just paid him.
Okay. That's like old school softball.
Yeah.
One guy does it, and you give him all the money for the jersey.
Dude, we're going to try to do it again in the spring. If the COVID stuff kind of is still, it's not looking like it's going to be happening in the spring as far as tour goes. So I think we're going to try to do it again.
Are you a gambler?
A little bit.
Are you gambling more now that it's legal here?
No, I was doing it the same before.
You were? Okay.
Yeah, so illegally.
To me, though, and I was too a bit, but I was so tired of paying in Bitcoin to an offshore site.
I was like, you get a check from like Armenia and the bank won't cash it or
sure they think there's some terrorist activity going on.
Of course, yeah.
And so I started to get tired of that. But now I'm on DraftKings three, four times a week.
Yeah.
It's the greatest new part of my life.
I've never done DraftKings because you do that kind of in a fantasy format, right?
Nope. You can, but I gamble on games.
Just regular?
Straight up.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Lines, you know. Money lines, spreads, just like anything else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that, especially during the break, because, you know, I'll do the radio show Monday through Friday morning, immediately leave and go shoot TV on the weekends. And whenever I'm doing, you can't gamble in every state. So I have to get my bets in before I leave.
I did
Tennessee.
That before I went to Colorado with Dirks and them.
Yeah.
I had to do all of my national, all of the playoff and all that stuff. And I did it like in the airport because I was like, oh my God, I'm about to screw up.
But that's how you know we have a problem. We're going, okay, am I crossing the state line yet? Can I still get a bet in?
Yeah. It's fun. It makes any game interesting. Like if there is a game on and it just started and it's the Knicks versus the Suns or whatever, and you don't care about it, then just put like $50 or whatever on it, and then it's like suddenly the most intense thing ever.
I had a seven, and I don't usually bet long parlays, but a seven-game parlay.
Dang.
And I got to the seventh game, and it was the Brooklyn Nets. I don't bet NBA much, but it's Brooklyn Nets, Cleveland Cavaliers. And Brooklyn was down by about 9 with 3 minutes left. They come, they tie and go to overtime. This is my seventh game, by the way.
Who did you have?
Money at Brooklyn.
Okay.
At Brooklyn. And it was a money line. I wasn't playing the spread.
Yeah.
All I needed to do was freaking win.
Yeah.
Seven games. I had put down $100. I was going to make $1,300. All they have to do is win the game. They lost my seventh game.
Oh,
they lost in double overtime.
In double overtime?
In double freaking overtime.
Wow, you don't
How do you
that.
Lose with James Harden, Kevin Durant, and Kyrie Irving?
Who were they playing?
Cleveland.
Cleveland. Oh, dude.
And you can also go, you know what? I'm going to take the money I've already won and check out. You can like go cash in.
I can do it because
I felt so good about the bet.
Oh yeah.
Wanted to pull my hair out.
Dude, my favorite one this year was I put $100 on LSU versus Florida money line. I had a gut feeling and they
basketball?
Beat them. Basketball? Football.
Oh, that's right.
And LSU because they were getting killed by everybody.
And Florida was still in the hunt to be in the national champ. You bet the money line?
Yes. And I was like, dude, I have a gut feeling LSU's going to play them at least a really good game and they beat them and that was my best of the year.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That was a fun one.
You play golf?
Yeah.
You good?
Yeah.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Oh, never mind.
Why?
It's just annoying.
Why?
You guys that come in and you can sing and you can write and you can play golf and you can play, like all that's just annoying to somebody like me who's had to like hustle and like grip my teeth for every single thing, to play golf, to play ball, everything. So when did you start playing golf?
When I was like 12.
Okay. So you've had a bit of history at it?
I have, and I mean, like, I'm not, like, fundamentally, like, you know what I mean? I don't have, like, the perfect swing or anything, but I've been playing a long time. I love it, dude. It's my favorite sport to play.
Who do you play with in Nashville?
Brad Tersey.
From Old Dominion?
Yes, a pretty good bit. I got a songwriter buddy of mine, James McNair, that I play with a ton. I play with Devin a good bit. I play with Jameson a good bit. There's a great community of dudes that play. A lot of people play golf, and I think a lot of people really picked it up this past year.
Yeah.
But I love it, dude.
You see my...
You're a lefty, so am I.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can never
use... a lot of lefties.
I can never use anybody's clubs.
I know.
And I can never play anybody's guitar.
Yeah. Oh, you play left-handed guitar. See, I play right-handed guitar.
Oh.
It's super weird.
Is it because there were... right-handed guitars available?
I think so. Like my first one as a gift was a right-handed guitar, but I it still feels like natural for me to play right-handed and not, I don't feel like I could play left-handed. So I think it is a natural thing somehow.
Yeah. If people are playing And they're like, hey, do that funny song that you do. And I'm like, all right, well, there's no freaking guitar.
That sucks.
It sucks.
That's worse than golf clubs because, like, at least you have your own in that situation. But that's like Denning is like that. I feel like Denning could play a right-handed.
I've played Travis's. He plays left-handed guitar. Yeah. But he's probably good. Keith Urban took my guitar once, who's not left-handed, and goes, let me see if I can destroy this. And he has a little conversation with both of his hands. And he goes, all right, you do this. And then he starts to play, I don't know, four times better than I do, left-handed.
Oh, my gosh. That would make me... He's unreal, dude.
Unreal.
That's so frustrating.
Like, he had a conversation. Oh, you're going to do what you usually do, and you do that. All right, break. And he's like...
Oh, my gosh. That's insane.
So amazing slash annoying.
I wish that there was more... there were more things like products and stuff that appealed to left-handed people.
You write left-handed?
I do.
Sucks, huh?
Yeah.
Especially when we had to use pencils at all because you got all of your hands.
Yeah, you'd have the. I thought about getting a tattoo one time where to get this whole thing shaded, to represent .
Because if you're left-handed, for those that don't know, and most of you don't, you have to drag your hand across the paper. Like you write,
you push, right?
And then you go across what you just wrote.
Yeah. So
it's always all over your hand. Yeah, life sucks, man. You guys don't even know, Mike. You have no idea how tough it is. In the winter, it's been because I have the simulator.
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, that's been where it's at.
I want one.
I've had more friends in the winter than I've had all year long.
That's funny.
They're like, hey, man, what you doing today?
You can play any course on there, right?
Yeah, mostly.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so that's been kind of the winter project.
Is it pretty? I mean, of course, it's a TrackMan, so it's like super accurate, right?
Yeah, it's.
Dang, man.
It's accurate. I say that, and I'm like, man, in real life, I wouldn't hit the shot that bad.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. I would have hit the shot that bad. So
that's cool.
Well, man, it's been good to hang out, good to talk with you.
Yeah, dude, thanks for having me.
No, for sure. Looking forward to see what happens with you next. I mean, it's that odd mix of you're kind of hitting in a lot of different ways at the same time. And for that, I commend you because that doesn't happen without a ton of hard work.
Thank you.
Like, you can be good. I have a lot of friends who are good at stuff but don't work, and it doesn't pop. Or maybe it just pops for a second. So to have this success, it's all kind of hitting you at once. It isn't by accident, and it isn't just because you're talented. You know, in this town where everyone is a giant, that the talent around you, everybody's amazing. For you to have this much success, I respect it.
Thank you.
I appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you, man.
And everybody,
it's been a pleasure.
Check out A-Rock. What is it? Say it.
I would say A-Rock.
Okay, that's what I would say.
That's what in conversation, I would say A-Rock.
Check out A-Rock.
It sounds like Iraq.
It does sound a little bit. All right. That's what's up. There is. Follow him on Instagram, at Hardy. Tough to get the handle?
I had to pay $500.
I just had to pay. Interesting. Well, first of all, I can't get at Bobby Bones for anything.
Because you're Mr., right?
For 5, 7, 8 years. I've offered money, and the person who has it doesn't even really use it.
Is it a guy, or is it you? They're posting stuff of yours?
It's a guy.
That's just like he's another Bobby Bones?
Yeah. Who in the world? That's a stupid name. It's not even my real name. Bobby is. Bones isn't. And so I've given up. And so I just use Mr. Bobby Bones, right? All across the board. Well, we started this kind of online cooking show. My fiance did. And it's called Unfancy Cooking. And I was like, this would be a good name. Let's name it that. She's really talented at it. So we did it. Somebody squatted as soon as we put it up, somebody squatted the Instagram.
Oh, no way.
So I get a message going, hey, I have this. If you want to buy it. And I was like, all right, give $50. Because, I'm going to reward you for your ingenuity
to go and grab it,
okay? As sleazy as it could be, that is legal.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
I said, give $50. They said, give me $1,000.
No way.
And I say, she put up one YouTube episode. It's not worth $1,000.
Oh, my gosh, dude.
So I say, don't message me again. Just playing. I'm just negotiating here.
All right.
And about a week later, they come back, okay, we'll do it for $750. I said, $45. Because I didn't need it that bad. And so, in the end, how much do you think I gave for it in the end?
$75.
Nah, I'm not that good of a negotiator. I ended up giving them $250.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
You got them down like $750. That's not bad.
I would have probably gone up a bit, but they kind of chickened out and thought I was going to walk. And that's the key.
Yeah, you're right. I'm so bad at that, dude. I need to be better.
Well, it's the risk of, if I screw this up, I'm going to get nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Well, listen, at Hardy, follow him. Good to talk to you, man.
You too, man.
And hopefully, I won't see you out anywhere because I don't go out. But other than that, I'll see you out there. All right, there he is. On right now is Barry Gibb, hey, Barry, how are you? I'm Bobby. It's really good to talk to you.
Hi, Bobby. How you doing?
Really good. I watched, first of all, I got to say, I was born in the 80s, but always loved the Bee Gees growing up.
But the the documentary, holy crap, was so good. I watched it last night.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, you know what? I haven't seen it.
are you kidding me? You didn't watch it back?
No, I watched the first cut and made a couple of comments. And, you know, deep inside, I knew that there's certain things were sort of different people's truths. And you just have to go with that. And Frank Marshall did an amazing job. And Nigel Sinclair. And I let go of it. I just can't watch my family disappear one by one, you know. And that's just too much.
And you don't plan to go back and watch it?
No.
Wow. Well, let me say, they did a fantastic job at taking me, who is a music fan. I mean, I do music for a living, taking me on an emotional roller coaster because, and again, since you haven't seen it, I'm sure you're going to know all that I'm talking about.
I know what it is. I know what it is. I don't need to see it, you know.
It was the many times, like the rise and fall, or the rise and slow stop for the Bee Gees. For example, you get a little famous, and then it kind of shuts down, and you go back to playing like the club, you know, back at home a little bit. Did you think then on the first kind of hiccup with the Bee Gees that it was over or you guys could climb back?
No. That was a one-time only thing. And we were working in about 97, beginning of the 70s. We were working in a couple of clubs in the north of England in the same places that Chuck Berry and Roy Orbison were playing. So, you know, there's nothing to be ashamed of there. So while we were doing that, yeah, it was quite a period before that. But while we were doing that, we had two number one records in America. So it was a little bit of a two-edged sword, you know. You're doing great over there, and you're not doing so well here. And, you know, we never did. We never were able to be constant. We just never were. It was never that. It was always what's next and take another shot. You know, dust yourself off, get back in the studio. We just sort of never stopped. We never gave up, you know.
You go and you're in this French chateau. You know, and it's Elton John had done a record and it was all fancy and you guys go and it wasn't quite as fancy as you thought, but you pushed on. But as you're there working on the next album, you get the script for what was going to be Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, that's true. And we didn't read the script. We listened to Robert Stigwood describe what he wanted to do with the film, and we started writing from there. We didn't want to be affected by the script. We just sort of wrote songs.
That was going to be my question. Like, did you read part of the script? But you read none of the script.
No. But we knew what it was, and we already knew about John Travolta, and Robert was off and running, and he wanted to do this, and we wrote for him. We always wrote for Robert, you know, to please him. It's great to write for other people, you know, to have someone in mind that you want to please, and that's how we did it.
When that record is out and you guys are now turned into not just superstars but mega stars, unlike anything really, you know, seen in 20 years since the Beatles or Elvis.
Yeah.
Was there ever a point where you felt like you couldn't even go outside?
Well, yeah, of course. You know, there were people climbing over our walls and the kind of thing that you might expect that comes from that kind of thing. We had a time of our lives. You know, we had a ball. I think a lot of people don't see the 70s the way we do. If you lived through it, it was quite an amazing period. There was no war. There was everybody wanted to go out. You know, there was a lot of fun being had. And our record label, Ahmet Ertegun, in fact, said, you know, you guys have got to kick it up. And that's where we reinvented ourselves, if you like. And the songs like Jive Talkin' and Fanny Be Tender and songs like that, a main course album, The Children of the World, they came about because of that. And and then Fever. So and Fever is a compilation. So it wasn't actually our album.
Right.
But boy, we had the time of our lives, Bobby.
You guys, and again, I know Dolly pretty well, and I knew Kenny a little bit before he passed away. And,
right.
You know, Islands in the Stream is such a mega hit for both of their careers and brands. And for you guys, for you to have written that, now, is it true that you were thinking about Marvin Gaye when you first did Islands in the Stream?
No, we were thinking of Diana Ross, you know, because Diana had asked us to write a song for her. So Islands in the Stream was probably going to be sent to Diana when I got the call from Kenny. And shows you how R&B can somehow coincide with country music. I'll never understand that. But he said, I want to do a duet, and I'd like to do it with Dolly. So that song fitted. He loved it. And so did Dolly. And she just set it on fire, you know. And it's her birthday today. And I wanted to have a happy, happy birthday. And she's become one of my dearest friends. And I could not wish more happiness on her than I am doing.
You know, she's on track 6, Words. It's, yes. You know, you and Dolly. And so when yes. You call Dolly up, do you send her a text? Or do you have a friend reach out to her? How does that work to get Dolly on a song?
Danny Nozell. We've become good friends. And he represents Dolly. And I think that it was probably between Dave Cove and others. I didn't contact her directly. It was. I just got the message. Dolly wants to do work. I didn't tell anyone what to sing. I didn't make the choices. Alison wanted to do Too Much Heaven, and you know, the greatest thing in the world, Bobby, is that they said yes. And they're some of the artists I admire most in the world. So it was me just rolling around in country music and bluegrass and working with the people I admire the most. You know. Now I was introduced to all of this through T.G. Shepherd and Kelly Lang. And they introduced me to Ricky Skaggs. Ricky got me on the Opry. Twice I did it, and one at the Ryman. And I was sucked in. I was done. This is the only world I want to be in. And Nashville is a city of music, you know, and I wanted to be there more than anything. So that's how it came about, you know.
You know, you talk about some of these amazing artists that's on the record, and I encourage everybody to check it out. It's, you know, the Gibb Brothers Songbook Volume 1. It is out now. It's got Dolly, Miranda, it's Olivia Newton-John, Jason Isbell. It's just loaded with talent. But I wonder, when you were 12 years old, whose record did you want to hear?
Roy Orbison. Roy Orbison without a heartbeat, without a second thing to think about it. My song, whatever I do songwriting, is inspired by Roy Orbison. I loved how his songs grew and took shape as they went along and got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think Running Scared and Blue Bayou and Crying and In Dreams and It's Over. And I was just in love with the guy, in love with the music. And Johnny Cash, I think, was right there too. But I wanted to sing like Roy Orbison. I wanted to write like Roy Orbison. So he would have been the single inspiration for me.
Was there ever a show where, when you guys were blowing up, or maybe you were, you know, hitting peak success? And I know at one point Barbra Streisand shows up in the documentary coming to your show. But was there ever someone that said, "Hey, I'm a big fan. I'm going to come to a show," and you're like, "I cannot believe they're coming to one of our shows"?
Well, I couldn't believe that. I mean, I couldn't believe that Barbra was there. Olivia was there, and Olivia was at one of her main peaks at that point. And I could never believe. You know, I believe Cary Grant was in the audience at the front, and if anyone had told me, I wouldn't have believed that either. So,
well,
you know, life is just full of surprises if you really want them. You know.
I think that the record is great. I hope people check it out. And then the documentary on HBO Max is just so good. And, you know, even if you were a fan already, and I consider myself, you know, a fan. If I know Massachusetts, I feel like I'm a fan. And I knew it, and it was a big part of it. And when Ed Sheeran sings it at the end, I was like in tears.
Wow. Well, you know, I love Massachusetts too. And that's the 60s, you know. It's just amazing that's 50 years ago, you know. That's outrageous, Bobby.
Well, Mr. Gibb, thank you for your time.
Oh.
You're a big superstar. I'm grateful that you give me a few minutes. And
are you kidding me?
Telling everybody to check out the record. And my friends that did the record, Little Big Town, was so...
They were wonderful.
They were so grateful to be able to work with you. What was it like working with them?
Pure pleasure. Pure pleasure. They... they are extremely, instant. They know exactly what they're doing. Very professional, wonderful harmonies. Didn't take long. And How Deep Is Your Love is their feature, you know. And I think they did another song, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They did they did How Deep Is Your Love, and they did Lonely Days.
There you go.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Trust me, I'm a big fan. I already know. I tell you the whole thing.
Yeah, you got a better memory than me, man. And they did How Deep Is Your Love was wonderful. I mean, that was wonderful. They didn't have to do that, you know. They didn't have to do two songs. And that's when you know. That's when you know people are real.
Well, thank you for your time. I hope you have an amazing day, and big fan, and hope everybody checks out the record and the documentary. Thank you very much, Mr. Gibb.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye now.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop before attending your next concert. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. Stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop new styles. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. You can probably spell it. You probably know it. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk Wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.